Okay, everyone, so we're going to be talking about emotions, specifically the emotion of compassion, and then the relationship between that and ethical and political life. And I think it's very interesting for its own sake, but also there was something in the news yesterday. I don't know if any of you saw something that happened yesterday in Oklahoma. Did anyone catch the news story? Someone in the first row is saying yes. So more than 500 people were given commuted sentences in the prison system in Oklahoma. And so Oklahoma has the highest rate of incarceration of any state in the United States. And then the U.S. has the highest rate of incarceration of any country in the world. So we have 2.1 million people in jail right now in the United States. And more than 500 were given shorter sentences yesterday. And many of them are being released in the coming days. So it's sort of interesting to think about why we want to do that sort of thing. There's always a cost calculation that can be made, but is there some reason other than that type of calculation for why that might be a good idea? If we go back to the ancients, they're actually interesting to look at in this regard. So the Stoics in particular are sort of more sophisticated than other ancient schools of thought when it comes to thinking about emotions, including the emotion of pity. And what makes them sophisticated is they're able to justify claims that ancients in general usually want to make. So one of the main claims they want to make is that violent or inappropriate emotions cause catastrophe at the social and political levels. So if you've ever read a Greek tragedy, you've seen this, right? They pick a relationship that's highly volatile, and they show how rage and jealousy and strong desire, sexual desire, how these have ramifications within the family of a person, but then within the wider society of the person, especially if one of them is a king or it has some type of political power. So the question of how to have healthy emotions was viewed as important for the cultivation of social and civic life, in addition to its importance for individual psychological development. And this is it's very easy to see how this is applicable for us at both the general level and the particular level, right? So even something as simple as a roommate, living with a roommate in college, no one wants a roommate who's gloomy all the time or who's jealous all the time, right? Or people talk about drama between roommates. And it's the same sort of problem, right? So what's interesting about the Stoics is they have a very particular and largely accurate way of describing what makes an emotion be inappropriate and what causes emotions in the first place. And because of that, they can give an analysis of moral and immoral virtues, how emotions are related to the virtues. So we're going to be looking at compassion as a case study. The reason that this emotion in particular is also interesting is Martha Nussbaum, who's highly famous. She's at the University of Chicago Law School. She has, in one of her books called Upheavals of Thought, she looked at Seneca and praised the egalitarian and cosmopolitan nature of the type of mercy that Seneca advocates. So this is just a brief overview of what Seneca holds about compassion and mercy. So most people probably haven't read Seneca at any point in the past, but he was an advisor to Nero, the Roman Emperor Nero, and he wrote this treatise called On Clemency or On Mercy. And what he says is that compassion or pity is a morally bad emotion, and therefore it's not beneficial to political society or in personal relationships. And here he's being a traditional Stoic. This is what the Stoic said. But he adds that there's a virtue called mercy, or clemencia, which is not the same as the emotion of compassion. By clemency, he means a tendency to pardon from or lessen punishment in such a way as to preserve the principles of justice. And the legal context here is one in which the magistrate has a range of possible punishments that he's allowed to impose. So once a person has been convicted of a crime, there might be several possible punishments that could be assigned, okay? And the magistrate has that ability to make the judgment call. So the virtue of clemency, Seneca says, is for those types of cases. And of course, the emperor has ultimate veto power to alter decisions of this type and also to institute policies. the last point is a very particular point about the history of Stoicism, which probably is not of interest to people, but we could come back to it later at the end if you want. I'm just going to show a few pictures of a trip that I took to Tunisia to look at Roman ruins in Tunisia, just to give some idea of the forensic context of Seneca's praise of mercy, why he thinks he needs to praise mercy to Nero. So this is the amphitheater in El Jem. How many people saw the movie The Gladiator? Oh, many people. Okay, so parts of the movie were actually filmed here. They used the ruins of this amphitheater for part of the film. And it was the third largest in the Roman Empire, so it seated 40,000 people. This is the equivalent of a carpet in a Roman home, a very wealthy Roman home. It was an enormous tile mosaic that was on the floor of someone's dining room or living room. And as you can see, what they think is appropriate and delightful to depict on their carpet is the amphitheater and scenes of gladiators fighting with wild animals. The stage in the middle is where, if the gladiator wins, he goes to receive his prize. And as you can see, they love to depict all the gore that's involved. This is like a tile that was on the side of the wall going around the edge of a dining room or a living room. And this is a different kind of game that they had in the amphitheater called the hunt, which is where they just put a bunch of wild animals that were natural predators or enemies and let them attack each other. And then you just watch it for fun. Okay, so you go to the amphitheater with your family, like going to a football game, except what you're watching is violence amongst animals who are, they've probably been, you know, starved, kept hungry, so that they will be particularly vicious in attacking each other right away. This is Dionysius in the middle, and the reason for that is that these games ultimately originated from Greece, and in Greece they started off as games in which the dead animals were then sacrificed to the gods. So in honor of various gods, they would have these games or fights and then offer the animals. Again, they love to depict the violence and the blood. This is another example. And this is my last picture of this, but it's when you enter the home of a wealthy person in the foyer on the floor, you see this. And in the upper right-hand corner, it's a symbol of the civic fraternity that the man of the house belongs to. So it's telling you that he belongs to a fraternity that paid for the purchase of leopards and ostriches to be donated for the games. So these civic games are going on every few days throughout the course of the year, and the wealthy are expected to be patrons of these games. So this kind of bloodlust and insensitivity to violence is deeply rooted in Roman society. So Seneca is doing something sort of radical, right, by telling Nero essentially to calm down or to practice mercy. Because in this society, there isn't really a level of sensitivity to pain, physical pain, or the thought that we should hold back. But the philosophers are saying we should be a little more reflective, okay, in how we get revenge or how we practice punishment. Now, Augustine goes even farther, and he says in the City of God that he endorses compassion, misericordia, and that this is the distinctive feature of his ethics as compared to Stoicism, which regarded compassion or misericordia as a morally bad species of emotion. So it's worth going into the theory of emotion a little bit to understand what this argument between Augustine and Seneca is really about. So, I mentioned at the outset that Stoics are sophisticated compared to other ancient models of emotion. And the main reason for that is that they're cognitivists when it comes to emotional theory. So they think that our emotions are caused by judgments that we make with our mind. It's beliefs that cause our feelings, our emotions. They do have a category of what they call the propatheia, which is the first, very first reaction. Instinctive gut reaction, but they say that doesn't actually count as an emotion. In order for something to be an emotion, you have to consent to the idea that you're justified in feeling this way. Okay, so it's not that they don't think that there are any type of first reactions at all, but like more like what animals have, but that they don't say that those are emotions. Okay, so emotions are caused by judgments. Now, this is interesting because today, if we think about today, CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, has been found to be very effective in treating various types of emotional disorders or conflict between people, right? So obviously, cognitive behavioral therapy only works if it's true that what's causing my distressing emotions are beliefs that need to be corrected, right? So CBT involves revising one's beliefs. And the ancient Stoics are the first to actually develop therapies like this. So they talk about pre-rehearsal, they talk about decatastrophizing, and these are all various mental activities you need to do to revise or correct your beliefs, to question the objectivity of your beliefs. So fear is caused by the judgment that something bad will happen in the future, grief by the judgment that something bad has happened in the past, desire results from the belief that something good is to be attained in the future, and joy is caused by the judgment that something good has happened. Adding to their sophistication, they say that these are genera, and each of these genera has multiple species emotions. So anger is a species of desire because it's a desire for revenge. Okay. Now, what makes emotions good or bad, morally good or bad, is the truth or falsity of the judgments. Okay. Now remember, your judgment is something you give consent to. You don't have a judgment unless you assent to a proposition in your mind. And this is why emotions can be culpable, because it involves voluntary assent to a proposition. So if I'm fearful about something, it's because I have said, yes, it's true that this situation merits fear. Now, if I've made a rash judgment and that's not true, that's a false proposition, then I can be blamed. I have some responsibility for having that emotion of fear, okay? Now, the other thing is, the truth or the falsity of the judgment, what they're interested in is not the factuality of it. So the assumption is the facts are correct, okay? They're talking about the value judgment that's involved when they're talking about a moral evaluation of an emotion, right? So if I have incorrect beliefs about what is good and what is bad, then I will have false beliefs causing emotions that are morally bad emotions, okay? Because it will show that my value system is off. Is this clear? So if I believe that I'm going to lose my job, but I'm really not, it's just a paranoid fear, that's not the kind of false judgment they're talking about, okay? They're talking about, it's true that I might lose my job. We've got that figured out already. And then the question is, am I right to be afraid of that? Am I right to think that that's a bad thing, to lose my job, okay? Okay, so here's where it gets a little more controversial. So the Stoics held that only morally good and bad things are good and bad, period. So only moral virtues and vices are good and bad. And the reason for this is they said, look, virtue is the only thing that produces happiness in humans. Everything else that I might have, like wealth, it could make me morally worse or it could make me morally better. It could make my life, my human life, my properly human life, better or worse. So it can be used well or badly. So the thing is not intrinsically related to my happiness one way or the other. Right. So if I acquire a lot of money and become a selfish, terrible person, it's actually worse for me that I got the money. So we're not going to call money good. We're going to say it's something indifferent. So many of us fall prey to the cognitive distortion of dichotomous thinking. So we tend to assume that many of the things that befall us are good or bad, but they're saying, look, that's not really true. That's a distortion in your thinking. In fact, most things that happen to you are indifferent to your happiness, okay? Like whether you got a job, whether you won the lottery, whether your father died, whether your child died, all these things are external things that are not your moral actions or moral virtues or vices. Now, that sounds kind of bizarre to say it's indifferent to me whether my child dies, but they subdivide the class of indifferent things into some which are absolutely indifferent, like the number of hairs on your head, who cares? Things preferable because they have value, for example, physical health, intellectual acumen, social relationships, and things that are dispreferred, which are the contraries of those things, okay? So if my child dies, that's a dispreferred indifferent thing. It means Everything else being equal, I prefer it not to happen. Okay, and I will act to prevent it happening because it's not desirable in its own sake, and it's not absolutely indifferent either. But if I have to choose between what is morally good and bad and the death of my child, what's morally good and bad is the thing that's really good or really bad, and the death of my child is a dispreferred indifference, something to be avoided if possible, but not the kind of thing I should get upset about. So I shouldn't have grief when my child dies. I shouldn't have grief if I have a low IQ. I shouldn't have grief if I get cancer. I shouldn't fear having cancer. I shouldn't fear losing my IQ through dementia. I shouldn't fear my children dying when they go to school for the first day of school, right? Okay. Now, there are good emotions for the Stoics. This is important because there's a caricature of the Stoics which says that everybody tends to think the Stoics think we should be like Spock, just completely indifferent, have no emotions whatsoever, and this is not what they think. So they do grant that there are wise emotions, the emotions of the wise person. Okay, so precaution is the right kind of fear. It's a fear of doing something immoral, right? So I'm getting ready to go out to a party, and I know that the last time I was with these people, I did immoral things. So I start to feel nervous getting ready for the party because I'm afraid I'll do something wrong again. The Stoics will say, this is a good emotion. This is an emotion of the wise person. Rational desire at the prospect of doing something good. So I look forward to visiting my grandmother in the nursing home because it's a good thing to do. It's the right thing to do. I owe that duty to my family members because we're social animals, according to the Stoics. Joy at having completed a good act. I paid my taxes. That was just, assuming that the tax code is just, which may or may not be the case. But assuming that the tax code is just, me paying my taxes is a just thing to do, and I will have joy, according to the Stoics, if I'm wise. Now, if I'm wise, I'm never going to do anything wrong, so I'm not going to have any grief, because the only thing that I would be sad about would be a true evil, which would be a moral evil, which would mean I had done something wrong, right? So this category doesn't exist for the paradigmatic wise person. Now, of course, there's people making progress towards virtue, and so those people are sometimes going to do wrong things, and then the appropriate emotion for them is going to be sadness that they messed up. But strictly speaking, that's not an emotion of a wise person, because you're not wise yet until you have all the virtues for the Stoics. If you're just making progress, your mind is still sort of confused, and this is why you sometimes choose the wrong thing. Okay. So I think we got that. I kind of anticipated this slide already. Let's talk about how Augustine critically develops this, and then we're going to go back again to the case of compassion and mercy. So Augustine agrees with them about the cognitive root of our emotions, right? Emotions are caused by judgments of the mind. This is what he thinks. He thinks they're right about this. And he actually accepts their therapies, and he adds some cognitive therapies of his own to their model. He also agrees that emotions can be morally good and morally bad based on the truth or falsity of the value judgments that causes them. But he disagrees with them that moral goods are the only goods. So this is, again, some detail on disagreeing with Sarabji's interpretation about the preliminary passions. We could talk about that at the end if people have that level of interest in the details. Okay, so what he does instead of saying that only the moral virtues and vices are good and bad is to say, look, there's eternal goods and there are temporal goods. And if you've read The City of God, how many people have read The City of God or any part of The City of God? Okay, not too many people, but it's one of his most famous works. And the theme of it is that there are two cities in the cosmos. And one city is made up of people who love God as the highest good, and then the other city is made up of people who are essentially selfish and love themselves as the highest good. And this basically maps onto love of eternal goods versus love of temporal goods as well. So the eternal goods are the virtues. They are goods which make their possessor good. They're called eternal because the only way I can lose it is through a voluntary choice. So it can be part of me endlessly unless I choose to get rid of it by doing the wrong thing. And then what the Stoics call preferable indifferent things, he calls temporal goods. And they're inferior because they're ontologically inferior. They're corruptible, changeable. They're therefore outside of our control, right? Because I can lose them even though I don't want to, unlike moral virtues. Okay, now he also revises the account of happiness. Some temporal goods are necessary for attaining moral virtues, and this includes the learning of moral virtues, right? So for example, if you're being tortured, you cannot attain happiness because you're so distracted by the torture that you can't really focus on learning virtues, let's say. If you already have virtues and you're tortured, that's a different situation, right? But you need a certain level of freedom from pain and a certain level of natural needs being met in order to learn virtues. You also need teachers or some book or something that's going to give you guidance. So you need certain temporal goods. All those things are temporal goods. But apart from those, you don't need other temporal goods to be happy, according to Augustine. So it's still sort of similar to what the Stoics say, right? If I can attain moral virtue securely and consistently, then I will be happy. That produces happiness in humans. Now, the definition of happiness here is the one that the Stoics use, which is doing one's proper human function. In other words, reasoning well in every situation, which means having moral virtue in every situation. It doesn't mean total satisfaction, right? There's two different ancient ways of talking about happiness. If you think of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics or Plato in the Apology and the Republic, you find both strands. And this is part of the reason why the Stoics get into an argument with the Peripatetics about what happiness is and what constitutes happiness. So doing a proper function is reasoning well. Another way of looking at happiness is to say it's total satisfaction. So what Augustine wants is to have both, to have his cake and eat it too. So he says the happy life is doing your proper function, which is having the virtues. And then there's the happier and happiest life, which are increasing degrees of satisfaction of desire. Okay, so you get more temporal goods after virtue, you're happier, you get the most, you're happiest. Now, the interesting thing is that we can't be happy in this life because we can't have secure moral virtue. And this is because our soul is corrupted by original sin, but also just because we're made from nothing, so we have this ontological entropy that extends even to our soul. And so we cannot have secure moral virtue here. So we can't even be happy. But then in the afterlife, you have only two options, ultimately, which are hell and heaven for Augustine. So you're either going to be happiest or unhappy, right? Unhappy here, unhappy in the afterlife, or unhappy here and happiest in the afterlife. All right, he does still have this distinction, as I said, between good and bad emotions. It cuts along moral virtue and vice versus temporal goods, just like for the Stoics, except he's saying that the preferred indifference are temporal goods. Within temporal goods, our emotion is supposed to be calibrated or proportionate to the level of temporal good that it is, right? So, I have an example up here. Yeah, getting a job versus getting an A, right? So here, both are temporal goods. So I'm allowed to have joy because they're good, but they're merely temporal goods. So, but I'm supposed to have more joy that I got a job than that I got an A, presumably, because one is more important than the other. Now, the last point is the most important. No magnitude of temporal good can ever outweigh an eternal good for Augustine. Furthermore, no set of temporal goods can ever outweigh a single eternal good, right? So it's still a very radical position. John Henry Newman has a famous quote in the Apologia. I was just in Rome 2 weeks ago for the canonization of Newman. And this slide always reminds me of Newman because he has a famous quote that says, the Catholic Church holds that it would be better for the entire universe and all of its inhabitants to perish and be exterminated than for one soul to commit one venial sin. And this essentially is Augustine's position, right? That the moral weight of something is always higher than even the set of all the temporal goods because they're just two different categories of things. All right, so his theory is still very austere, like the Stoic theory, but it's better, I would argue. Because, I mean, the Stoics essentially have to tie themselves into knots by trying to say that sickness, physical injuries, betrayal by friends, poverty, loneliness, lack of education, etc., are not relevant to our well-being or happiness. And if you've ever known anybody who tried to live as a Stoic, I tried to do it, actually, for a while in grad school. it doesn't actually give you a healthy emotional life because it just gives you, you just become bitter, right? Because you end up sort of being angry a lot. But then you're not supposed to be angry. You're supposed to repress your anger, et cetera. So it just sort of leads to this sort of hardened bitterness in people, right? So he's got a better ontology. He's got a better definition of happiness and its degrees. And therefore, he can avoid, and he's got this idea of the afterlife, so he can avoid the problems in Stoicism. All right, so let's come back to compassion and mercy. So we saw that the paradigmatic sage for the Stoics does not have any grief, and therefore he doesn't have any compassion, because compassion is a species of grief. So compassion is feeling sadness at the ills of another person, or the evils that another person is suffering. The bad things, okay? The Stoics said, okay, the wise person doesn't have this because since he's wise, he never commits any moral evil, right? Now, there's a problem with this. So the first critique, there's actually two problems, but the first critique is that the Stoics contradict themselves. Augustine thinks the Stoics contradict themselves. So they don't want the sage, the wise person, to grieve either, even when other people are in true evils, truly bad things, even by their own definition of bad things. In other words, moral evils. So if you think of the chorus in Euripides' Medea, she's decided to take action in revenge against her husband, Jason, who has cheated on her, right? So she's overcome with jealousy and rage. And she decides, well, the best way to get even with him is to do something that she knows is going to cause her children to be murdered. So she becomes a murderess of her own children. And as she's deciding to do this, the chorus has a function, as usual in a Greek tragedy, to give some kind of evaluative criteria to the audience for how to understand the action. And the chorus goes into a lament about how she's defiling her own soul by doing this heinous act. So the question would be, why do the Stoics say that that's irrational? Emotions are supposed to be wise, good, if they're caused by a correct value judgment about what's really good and what's really evil. Okay? If I see that someone else is about to do something evil, why can't I have precaution in that situation? They had talked only about the wise person not having grief at her own moral evils, right? She doesn't do anything wrong, so she's not going to have grief. But then the question is, what about other people, right? Why would that be irrational? So Seneca, in the De Clementia, he tries to kind of like deal with this problem somewhat, okay? And he says that, well, feeling compassion is bad because it clouds the judgment, but this is not a good argument because the Stoics, if they thought that all emotions cloud our judgment, they wouldn't have the category of the good emotions at all, right? They would just say we should be Spock, but that's not what they hold. And then the other argument is one we've already seen, but that's irrelevant to the question of grief over other people's moral failures. So they really have no answer to this question. They give no reason for omitting an emotion of clemency from the set of morally good emotions. If the Stoic wise person cared about virtue for its own sake, then the matter of whether virtue or vice were one's own or another's would not be a deal breaker. Whoops. So it looks arbitrary, right? It seems like they just put this arbitrary prohibition on grieving over other people's moral failings or faults. So Augustine thinks, okay, the real motivation for the Stoics doing this, I know what it is. I can read their minds. I've figured out what's really driving them to do this. And this is that they know, they see that most people's lives are messed up. Most people are morally bad. They make bad moral choices. They create a mess all the time in their relationships, in their workplaces, in politics, etc. And if I were to be caring about those things, I would constantly be getting upset. I mean, all I have to do is open the paper and see, right, that some man beat his wife, or that somebody murdered somebody, or a woman put her child in the trash bin or something. So this is not an enjoyable way to live. So we're going to say that the wise person will only have emotions about her own moral states, and we're just going to cut other people off from objects of concern. So the Stoics are secret Epicureans, right? This is Augustine's charge. Because the Epicureans thought the goal of life was the avoidance of pain, aka seeking pleasure, either static pleasure or kinetic pleasure. And he just thinks they're just afraid of the pain, of being upset. So obviously that's a huge problem for the Stoics, because the entire Stoic system of ethics is built in a dialogue debate with the Epicureans, right? A fundamental disagreement about what the primary objects of our natural desires are. For the Epicureans, they're saying it's pleasure. Every animal aims at pleasure. Humans are animals. Animals aim at pleasure naturally. The Stoics are denying that. They're saying, no, all animals aim at what's healthful for themselves, including humans. And pleasure is just a byproduct. That's not a real motivator. So, this is his first critique. Now, it's worth asking, is this really doing justice to them? Let's look a little more closely at Seneca's clemency. It's an inclination to dispense with rules governing retribution whenever circumstances indicate that the principles of justice have been satisfied, typically that the guilty party has learned her lesson. So the Stoic view of punishment is that moral reform is the purpose, is the goal of punishment. And it follows from this that it's acceptable to remit punishment if the end is attained before the sentence commences or during its duration. Secondly, it's a lack of virtue to continue punishing after there's evidence that the guilty party has learned the lesson. This would be the passion of anger, a desire for revenge, right? There would be no purpose to continuing the punishment for the Stoics. So clemency is a sensitivity that recognizes reasons for lightening a sentence. The perpetrator is old and frail, and so he learns his lesson with a lighter punishment because he feels it more, or is repentant already, or is young and inexperienced, and therefore was acting from only partial voluntariness and hence easily regrets the action. When Seneca says he doesn't want compassion, what he means is he doesn't want mercy that acts from feelings of pity without regard for justice. So sentimental people, he says, want to throw open the doors of prisons and let out the most harmful criminals if once they see them cry. And this is how he defines compassion. So now that we've gone back to Seneca and looked at actually at what he's talking about when he says compassion, it looks actually very attractive, right? It looks attractive. And Augustine, too, is committed to a virtue ethics in which deviations of justice are conceived of as harmful both to the person who's treated unjustly and also to the moral character of the one who acts unjustly. So what actually is his real disagreement with Seneca on compassion and mercy then? When we look at his letters, we can also see that he uses Seneca's criteria for clemency in what he advocates. So the interesting context here is that bishops at the end of the Roman Empire, after Constantine, had moral suasion with the magistrates. So they felt very free to write to the magistrates and to plead for a particular punishment to be applied or not to be used. And what happens also is that the bishops write to each other. So if you've read the Confessions, you know that Augustine's friend was Alypius. One of his major friends in the early 20s was named Alypius. So Alypius, Nebridius, these people who were his friends when he was a late teenager, early 20s, they all became bishops in North Africa. So they write to each other and they say, hey, what do we want? What do we want to happen in the political order? And then they write to the magistrates and lobby for a specific policy or a specific punishment to be used or not to be used. So even when he's calling mercy, compassion, using the word that Seneca was using and that he says he disagrees with Seneca on, he's actually talking about what Seneca calls clemency a lot of the time. So, for example, he says physical torture is abhorrent to our way of thinking. And this is why he didn't want to press criminal charges against the suspected and instigators of a church burning and looting in his diocese, who would have been subject to torture under interrogation. He says that some proportionate punishment must be imposed, and so therefore for the known culprits, he advocates a heavy fine as a punishment instead of beating because of compassion. However, he thinks that if this less severe punishment cannot be secured from the magistrate, the full force of a law is preferable to a simple pardon. Okay, so this is key. He basically thinks of what he's calling compassion as a species of justice. It's what Aristotle calls epieikeia in the Nicomachean Ethics, which just means application to the particular case. You have to have the ability to see how justice should be applied correctly in particular situations. If you've read the Confessions, you know how he talks about his childhood beatings, right? He goes to school, he doesn't do his homework, so he gets beaten at school. Then he goes home, and his parents see the marks from the cane on his body, and they laugh at him, okay? Because, again, this is the Romans. So they have no problem with, like, you know, beating, bloodlust, etc. So what he says in the Confessions about that is very interesting. He says, the people who beat me were wrong because it was an exaggerated punishment for not doing my homework. My parents were also wrong to mock me in my pain. However, it was better for me to be punished overly harshly than not to be punished at all because I was guilty for not doing my homework, right? So he thinks in the fallen world, typically justice is not applied correctly. And it's better for it to be overly harsh than overly lenient. So if there's a conflict between mercy or compassion and justice, you should go with justice, right? So the ultimate criterion of compassion is not what the perpetrator of crime finds subjectively bearable, but his true, in other words, moral interests. So the compassion that Augustine advocates is therefore highly moralizing and subject to the demands of justice, just like Seneca's clemency. And this leads us to a puzzle. Why does he call it compassion instead of just calling it clemency? It seems like he got some of his ideas about compassion from Seneca's clemency. And the answer here is that he wants mercy, clemency, to be an emotion and not just a disposition to do actions. So again, if you think of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, there's virtues that pertain to action and virtues that pertain to emotions, right? So there's moderate anger, for example, and then there's the virtue of justice, which is doing actions that people deserve. So the critique that Augustine has is that Seneca is saying that mercy is only to do with actions, and he wants to say it's also a virtue that has to do with feelings. So it's not enough to be a good person to just dispense aid as a bureaucrat, right, efficiently, et cetera, helping people without feeling any type of fellow feeling with them. This is his claim. So he says it would have been much more humane for the Stoics to appraise the feeling of compassion. In other words, Seneca didn't go far enough when he said that clemency is a particularly humane virtue concerned with action. So he wants clemency to be defined as a good feeling, a good emotion, accompanying a tendency to do good works. Why then does he use this word misericordia, compassion? It's because it's the only word that the Stoics have that connotes a feeling connected with feeling for other people, right? And so he's keeping elements of the conceptual distinction between just pity that's pure sentimentality and then clemency, which is subject to justice. And he's saying, I can use misericordia, the word compassion, for an emotion that is linked to concern with justice as well, right? Okay, now, we might want to ask why it's so important to Augustine that we sympathize with the people that we help. I mean, if I write letters to a magistrate and get somebody off of the death penalty or prevent them from being tortured. Why isn't that enough? I mean, what more do you want from me, Augustine? And he's saying, I want you to feel a certain way. And the question is, why? Why does it matter? So this has to do with the eusocial nature of humans. Eusocial is a term that we use today in biology to talk about social animals. Of all the social species, some are eusocial, and humans are eusocial, and arguably the most social of the eusocial. So the Stoics actually said that. See, the Stoics emphasize heavily that humans are the most social of the social animals. And Augustine agrees with them about that. And he thinks it just follows from this that we should have human charity towards everyone in the human race. He says this very clearly. So it's not appropriate for humans not to feel sadness when other people are suffering temporally bad things, temporal bads. Instead of temporal goods, temporal evils, right? Those merit a reaction from us. And then, of course, he thinks that they have this faulty evaluation of embodied human life. So things like torture, things like the death penalty, the Stoics don't really get worked up about those in the same way that the African bishops do. And this is because the African bishops, or Augustine anyway, has a philosophical view that temporal goods of the body and temporal evils of the body are in fact good and evil. So love of neighbor or human charity entails wanting physical good things for other people as well. So if we think back to the case of the looters, the people who looted the church and burned the church in his diocese, he didn't want them to be tortured. And the reason is that what I was just saying, right, the body. So corporal punishment is something to be feared and sorrowful about, even if it's still preferable to no punishment at all, which he definitely thinks. This also extends to guilty criminals and their victims, right? Their victims, obviously, but guilty criminals too. So we can confirm this with a parallel case of abduction, human trafficking. So merchants were abducting free people from the African coast and selling them into slavery in other provinces. And Augustine feels the urgency of working to free these people. And he writes to the other bishops and he says, if we don't do something about this, we don't have compassion on these people, no one else will do it who has any type of power. But he also wants compassion to extend to the slave traders themselves. He doesn't want them to be punished according to the applicable law, because it prescribes beating by whips tipped with lead, which can lead to death. So he suggests prosecuting them under a different law that can also be construed as relevant, which would entail a more prudent or more proportionate punishment, he thinks. So this is very interesting, the total lack of legalism, right? I can use pretty much any law that I can make the system accept as a valid law to use in order to get the right level of punishment or the right type of punishment. So the justification here is, okay, if we beat people with these types of whips, they might die because they're in a Roman prison, poor sanitation, they get open wounds, they get infections, it's cold and damp, they die. But he's not opposed to the death penalty in principle, just like he's not opposed to torture in principle. Okay, this is something we can talk about maybe in the question period. He's not saying either one is an intrinsically evil act. Okay, again, he advocates a fine. This is his typical go-to punishment, is a heavy fine. And the idea is it's supposed to be heavy enough that the person spends a significant amount of their life working in order to pay this fine, but they have enough so that they're not completely destitute, right? Because if they're completely destitute, they're going to be motivated to engage in crime to get more money. So they're going to have just what they need, just their necessities. They're not going to be able to save up money to get luxuries or a very nice lifestyle. The reason he doesn't want the death penalty is because, as it says there, he doesn't want to cut off the time for repentance. So he thinks the hope is always that the person will, through their punishment, will repent, right? Okay, we've talked about this. Okay, again, the properly compassionate person cares more about someone's moral state than their physical state, but should care about their physical state. This goes back to the category difference between eternal goods and temporal goods. All right, finally we come to Nussbaum and what she says here. Okay. She does not deal with Augustine, unfortunately. She should have done that. He has a better and more sophisticated account, I think, for what she wants, to justify what she wants. So Nussbaum said that part of what motivated the Stoic repudiation of compassion was respect for persons as dignified agents. She said their view was strongly egalitarian and cosmopolitan, being rooted in a conviction that humanity has dignity by virtue of its power of choice, or proheiresis. The problem with compassion is that compassion fails to give adequate attention to the natural dignity of the person, since it focuses on accidental features of the suffering person's life, on what has happened to someone rather than on his or her rational capacity for moral choice. Now, it's true that the Stoics imply that compassion devalues a human being. And it does seem to be rooted in a refusal to identify a person with his or her bad fortune. So Seneca, for example, he criticizes self-congratulating pitiers who are averse to the people that they pity. They shrink from contact with handicapped people, elderly people, the destitute. He says they insultingly fling their alms while averting their glance. Apparently, such people are repulsed because they make this false identification of bad or repulsive circumstances with bad or repulsive human being. Perversely, these people also like there to be needy people because it provides an opportunity for them to look compassionate and to feel proud of themselves for acting compassionately. They do not regard the recipients of their alms as equals but inferiors. This Stoic point is insightful and, again, rather attractive, as was their earlier stipulation that compassion ought not to violate justice. I'm sure I've had the experience of going on a service trip over spring break or something, right? You go to Mexico, you build houses or do Habitat for Humanity or something. And you can kind of think, well, I'm doing this. Everybody else is going to Hawaii or going on a cruise, you know. And you can take pleasure in the fact that you're morally superior, right? You're helping these people, right? And that's the kind of thing the Stoics are pointing out and criticizing, right? That ultimately then it becomes all about me. And a lot of the people who say they're compassionate, it's really just all about them, is the critique. However, and this is where I disagree with Nussbaum, the Stoic attempt to articulate what does constitute human dignity is, I put questionable, but I think it's just very different from what Nussbaum says. So the whole emphasis of Stoicism implies that the dignity of a person resides in her acquired moral character. Okay, so Nussbaum mentions proheiresis, the power of choice. This term occurs mostly in Epictetus. She doesn't say who she's thinking of, but it has to be Epictetus. And so it does name the power of rational choice, but also frequently it names the dispositions acquired through the repeated use of this power. So he says proheiresis, or free choice, or our mind, our rational mind, has qualities. It's either morally beautiful or morally ugly. The power is valuable only as instrumental for attaining the right kind of disposition. In other words, for becoming beautiful. So when the Stoics execrate compassion, they are not making a choice between identifying someone with her bad fortune and with her rationality, but a choice between identifying someone with her bad fortune and the way she uses her rationality, in other words, her moral character. If you act contrary to virtue, it follows from that, then the fact that your action was preceded by assent means that you acted from a failure to reason well, and also that you acted voluntarily. If you persist in making bad choices, you will certainly lack the moral identity which merits admiration. It is by no means clear from what the Stoic sources say that I still owe you respect. It would, moreover, be irrational for me to have solicitude for your moral excellence, given that your state is voluntary. So I think Nussbaum has a tendency to read Kant back into some of these ancient authors, Enlightenment figures like Kant, and this is one example of that. So we don't really have in the Stoics a robust account of inalienable dignity, right, that commands respect no matter what people have done. And therefore, we can't really use Seneca to ground an egalitarian Stoic mercy, right? Like Nussbaum wants, right? Now, final point about Augustine. He retains this Stoic insight about perverse pitiers. In his commentary in the Gospel of John, he says this: "We should not wish people to be wretched so that we may be able to practice works of mercy. If you render service to a wretched person, perhaps you desire to extol yourself before him and wish him to be subject to you because you have benefited him. He was in need, you bestowed. You seem to yourself greater because you bestowed than he on whom it was bestowed. Wish him instead to be your equal." Now, he grounds this in a metaphysics that can actually back up the egalitarian claim, okay, that Nussbaum wants the Stoics to be backing up, but they're really not. And his ontology of the human person is deeply indebted to Plotinus. So the basic idea is the soul is the image of God, the body is the image of the soul. So the soul is a superior kind of substance because it's immaterial, and its intellect is an image of the mind of God, making it immortal. And this ontological excellence justifies lamentation at the fact that people defile their souls with moral evil. The body has borrowed dignity given that the intellectual soul forms the body. So it's not irrational to grieve when someone's tortured, their corpse is left to be eaten by birds, or to fear that these things happen or get angry at people who want to do them. So ontological goodness, right, is prior to and distinct from acquired moral character. And this is something that can give you an egalitarian ethic with regard to mercy, Augustinian mercy. All right. Christianity, we might think mercy is particularly Christian. As I hope I've shown, a lot of what Augustine says about mercy he gets from Seneca, and so that's actually not true. It's not particularly Christian. What is specific to Christianity? Just an extension of these ontological points, right? So the manner in which the incarnation was accomplished showed the goodness of both male and female bodies. This is something that sets Augustine apart from other ancient authors. He says, God became incarnate as a male in a female, talking about Jesus and Mary, in order to show the goodness of both male and female bodies. He's saying that in contrast to other currents of ancient thought, which said that the female body is defective in relation to the male or in comparison to the male body. And that redemption, God wanting to redeem us, was motivated by the beauty of the soul, the ontological beauty of the human soul. The fact that God sees his own image in humans is what actually draws him to love human beings and then to want to redeem them after the original sin. So that's pretty much all I have to say. I have a couple pictures of graves from North Africa. These are Christian graves, as you can see from the key row at the top. And what's interesting about these is that when there's a death of a child, they count the number of hours that the child lived. So they tell you on the grave, the person died, you know, in the 8th month, on the 25th day, in the 16th hour of the day, right? Which is very different from Epictetus, right? The Stoic philosopher Epictetus, we were just talking about. One of the therapies he recommends is when you kiss your child goodnight before they go to bed, tell yourself he may be dead by the morning. And the purpose is to remind yourself that this child is a preferred indifferent. This child is not actually related to my happiness strictly, right? So I can be happy without that child, and the child may die, and I'm not going to be sad if that happens, right? So anyway, we probably don't have to spend a lot of time translating it, but trust me, that's what they say. And then this one is an adult. So it's telling you he lived 43 years in Pache, rest in peace. But at the very top, you see the key row at the top and the alpha and omega on either side, and then his name, and then underneath that it says Pauperum Amator, lover of the poor. Right? So, again, the concern for the body, that's part of the kind of ontology that Augustine has, is just of a piece with Christianity. But it's also something you find, you know, in other ancient philosophies, right? So it's not specifically Christian only, but it is distinctive from, if you compare it to the Stoicism, right? Okay, that's all I have to say. Questions? Comments? Hope?
I have a question about the part about having mercy or compassion for people who have, you know, out of maybe their circumstances that are not under their control, having compassion for them versus having compassion for someone who's in a state of moral evil. It seems like there should be more compassion for someone who's in a state of moral evil, because that's a worse evil,
right,
than for a poor person who has, like, no, maybe no material wealth, but, like, their moral status might be fine,
mm-hmm,
right? That seems, mm-hmm, that seems less bad.
Right.
Under this.
Yes,
view,
yes, yes,
right?
Yes.
I don't know. That's interesting, because it's not intuitive, I guess.
Right. because the person in moral evil chose it themselves.
Yeah, or it's, maybe I'm talking about it more from, like, a popular perspective. It seems like there should be more compassion for someone who's in a state of maybe, like, material evil, but
mm-hmm,
not in a state of moral evil.
Well, remember that the compassion is this clement compassion, right? So it doesn't mean that you're going to be, like, grieving your entire life over somebody, because it's, the criteria of justice are always governing the situation. So if you try to help the person, then you try again. I mean, what it ends up being is you're hoping that eventually they're going to listen or change. But you don't, you're not weeping. For Augustine, you're not weeping all the time about the fact that they're voluntarily doing, knowingly doing bad things. Mm-hmm. On the assumption that they don't know, that's initially why you talk to them, right? And try to inform them. But once it becomes clear that it's chosen and they're not repentant,
mm-hmm,
you're not going to be grieving about it, because you've tried, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you should still have this human charity, okay, which is the hope that eventually you could talk to them again or something might change, right? So it's a little bit different from, you know, Aristotle and Nicomachean Ethics talks about, what if you're friends with somebody and then they lose their virtues and they become worse and worse and worse. He basically says you just write them off. Like, there's not this thing of, like, keeping the door open necessarily. Whereas this idea that we have to have human charity for everyone in the human race implies that we have to at least always be hoping that they're going to,
because everyone has a soul,
become repentant, right? And because they're part of our social group, no matter what. Yes, Alex, I think?
Yeah.
So
you kind of suggested asking about it, so I'm going to ask about it.
Sure.
It's kind of a boundary case, but for Augustine, would he think that, like execution, would he think that it would be better for someone to be executed than not punished at all? That was kind of the boundary case, which, yeah.
Probably, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he thinks that not having the death penalty is preferable, but he doesn't think that it's something that has to be avoided at all costs. And also, I mean, his argument for why it should be, I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit, but his argument for why it's preferable not to use it is very weak. Because he just says, well, the person doesn't have enough time to repent. But you could just argue, well, look, the person spends 50 years in jail with their friends, how's that going to help them repent? But if they know they're going to die in a month, they're more likely to repent, right?
Yeah.
So, plus we save a lot of money. No, just kidding. So he doesn't think it's intrinsically wrong, so it doesn't have to be avoided at all costs.